This episode of Special Sauce is brought to you by Capital One Saver Card. Earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment, 2% at grocery stores, and 1% on all other purchases. Now, when you go out, you cash in. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Welcome to Special Sauce 2.0. Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we begin with Ask Kenji, where Kenji Lopez-Alt, Serious Eats chief culinary consultant, gives the definitive answer to the question of the week that a serious eater like you has sent us.
A general rule of thumb for cooking is if you can smell it, that means that its concentration in the pot is going down. You know, the more you smell red wine in your house, the less is left in the stew.
After Ask Kenji, a conversation with our guest, Adam Chandler.
They have something called a breakfast taquito, which is eggs, a tortilla, hash browns, and American cheese. My deep-fried Madeline right there. It's just perfect. It's perfect. You know, it's perfect.
And finally, on today's podcast, a teachable moment from the Serious Eats Test Kitchen.
That old cooking tip that you should not flip your meat too much is not true. The more you flip it, the more even of a doneness you'll get in the center.
First up, our chief culinary consultant, author of The Food Lab, Kenji Lopez-Alt. And Kenji, Mark Lampert wants to know, he says, I was wondering about the process of cooking with umami sources. Does umami cook out like an acid would? For example, if I add fish sauce at the beginning of cooking a stew, would the perceived umami be the same as if I added it at or near the end of the cooking process of the stew?
You know, that's a very good question. First of all, acid doesn't really cook out. So if you're, like, say you're making a vinegar reduction for a béarnaise sauce, the reduction is going to be much higher in acidity than the one you started out with, although some amounts of the acetic acid will also be evaporating. But acid does concentrate as you cook. As far as the things that trigger the sense of umami, so those are typically we're talking about glutamic acid and maybe inosinic acid, a couple of other amino acids, but those are the sort of big ones. Those are chemical salts. They dissolve in water, and I am almost completely positive that they do not evaporate, or they do not leave in great quantities with the water as it evaporates. I imagine that it would behave sort of similar to salt, where if you're boiling a pot of salted water, little bits of salt might escape mainly through actual liquid water sort of splashing out of the pot and taking some of the salt with it. But the steam itself, the water vapor itself, is not going to contain any salt. And so similarly, yeah, in fact, I'm positive of this because you can see this when you if you boil a pot of water that has any sort of MSG, glutamic acid in it, and you let it condense on the lid of a pot, when those droplets sort of dry, they don't leave any kind of trace minerals behind or anything. So most of that is going to stay in your pot.
So do you add the fish sauce at the beginning or at the end?
The short answer would be, as the answer to almost all these questions is, follow the recipe. Presumably the recipe tester has tested that. With something like fish sauce, I generally add it, if I'm cooking at home, maybe I'll add a little splash at the beginning and then add a fresh splash at the end, because some of those sort of funkier flavors cook off as it reduces. So a general rule of thumb for cooking is if you can smell it, that means that its concentration in the pot is going down.
Got it.
So if you are cooking a stew and it smells like there's this wonderful red wine aroma, that means that, you know, the more you smell red wine in your house, the less is left in the stew. There's a finite bucket of it. And it's if it's in your house, then it's not in your pot.
Right. So that's a bad sign, even though it makes the house smell good.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, it depends. Some of those flavors you do want to burn off. You know, the harsher flavors. With fish sauce, you know, you add a splash of it, and you can immediately smell that like super funky fishy aroma. And that's because it's cooking off. It's not going to be in the pot anymore. So if you don't like that aroma at all, and you want to minimize the funkiness, add it at the beginning. If you like it, and you find that it's it improves your food, then add a little bit at the end. Or you can do, you know, what I do, which is a little splash at the beginning and a little splash at the end to sort of brighten it up.
Got it. I think Mark is in much better shape as a result of this.
All right.
Kenji Lopez-Alt is Sirius Eats' chief culinary consultant and author of The Food Lab. Send your questions to Kenji to specialsauce@SiriusEats.com. Okay, now I have the distinct pleasure of talking with Adam Chandler, a former staff writer for The Atlantic. Chandler has just published his first book, Drive Through Dreams, A Journey Through the Heart of America's Fast Food Kingdom. I loved your book, man.
Thank you.
It was really awesome. I have a zillion questions for you that will require roughly as much time as two drive-through appearances 60 miles apart.
Sounds great.
First of all, tell us about life at the Chandler table growing up. I assume you didn't eat fast food every meal.
I did not. Although if we're talking about the Chandler household, maybe there's a couch I can just lie back on.
Yeah,
and
you
I'll
can.
Start.
That's what we sometimes have a couch, and right. then I tell you to stop. We have to stop now. Don't worry.
Right. You're on vacation
yeah.
all of August.
Yeah,
okay, got
exactly.
it. Well, I did eat a lot of fast food growing up, and this has to do, I think, in large part because I grew up in Texas where car culture kind of reigns supreme.
Mm-hmm.
You drive everywhere in Houston, and that really kind of influences the way that eating happens. I also had two working parents, so I didn't have, which in 1980s Texas seemed a little strange, the traditional mom stays home and cooks dinner paradigm that I think a lot of my friends and a lot of people around me did. So dinner was often eaten out or on the go. And
really?
Yeah. So it was less traditional. I hope she doesn't tune in. I hope
That's
she,
okay,
I hope
man.
She
we,
does.
We...
My mother is not a fantastic cook, and neither is my father. And
welcome
she...
to the parents not being fantastic cooks club, which I am president and founder.
She has since become a magnificent cook. My dad remains cooking agnostic, but she waited till I left the house for that to happen. So a lot of it had to do with time, and a lot of it had to do with skill and function. So I think that's how I ended up eating dinner out a lot, and on times when we were pressed for a quick meal, fast food kind of factored in. I was also a fussy eater, so
that... Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, were you a picky eater?
This is really my fault. I like to send the blame elsewhere. I'm going to have to lie down on the couch now. Yeah, I was a fussy eater, and I hated vegetables until I was in my 30s, which, you know, is a long time. And so I ended up eating a lot of hamburgers.
You obviously love fast food, and one of the things I love about the book is that you are an unabashed fan of fast food, which has caused you a lot of blowback in the social media world, right?
Yes, definitely. As, you know, as I expected it to, but there are more people who love fast food than hate it, and that's the statistics are pretty clear on that.
So did your parents approve? Did they enthusiastically endorse fast food growing up?
I think there was definitely more of a let's just get this over with kind of attitude to eating. We did dine out a lot. Houston's a great food city now.
Amazing. And you wrote this beautiful piece after the hurricane about what an amazing city Houston has become in terms of its ethnic diversity and everything else.
Houston has become even more interesting as a culinary city. It's a very hot culinary city right now. But even growing up, I had access to really excellent food. I didn't always have really excellent food. Sometimes it was a means to an end, as, you know, a bucket of KFC coming home from soccer practice or something like that, which feels, you know, normal and relatable. And this was the time, I think, before fast food was really demonized in the way that we know it to be demonized in sort of the culinary consciousness of today.
Give us your sort of quintessential fast food experience as a teenager.
As a teenager? There isn't one. There are a few. There are a few. One is, you know, sneaking out of high school to go get Whoppers with my friends. And that was, we had off-campus lunch, but we never had enough time to do it. And so we would go, and one of us would get our car, and we would run to the Burger King that was relatively close to school on 99-cent Whopper Day. And my friends would basically have a Whopper eating contest, which I don't recommend.
Oof.
I know.
That's painful.
It was. We all had, I think, economics right after lunch, and none of us learned a thing about economics after that. We just fell asleep in that class. Then we had this ritual. We had this Texas chain that everybody from Texas will tell you is the best food in the world. It's called Whataburger. Most people know it or have met a Texan who will die on the hill that it's better than In-N-Out and better than any other fast food restaurant there is. And at 11 p.m. every single night, they serve breakfast, which is a brilliant stroke for people who are...
Drunk food
or leaving the rodeo and just want something. You know, it's really perfect for what it is. So on weekend nights, we would all pile into our cars and go to Whataburger. It was the last thing we did before we rushed across Houston to go home for our curfews. And that was our sacred ritual. I have the fondest memories of sitting down and having breakfast with my friends right before we all went to bed. And there was something that felt kind of transgressive about it, but it was actually the most wholesome way to spend, you know, the last 45 minutes before someone's parent would be tapping our foot. We didn't have cell phones. You know, this was the last few
right.
years before cell phones were ubiquitous. And so we could kind of set a clock to our Whataburger experience. We waited for 11 o'clock. We had our breakfast, and then we went home.
What was your breakfast of choice at 11 p.m.?
Well, this has been supplanted by other items in popularity. They have something called the honey butter chicken biscuit, which people are obsessed with now. They didn't really have that when I was growing up, but they have something called a breakfast taquito, which is eggs, a tortilla, hash browns, and American cheese.
Oh, yeah. You write about that in the book.
Right, right. And, you know, it's my deep-fried Madeline right there. It's just perfect. It's perfect. You know, it's perfect.
I think... Maybe you and I should collaborate on a book, and it should be called Deep Fried Madeleines.
I would love that. I'm game for that. Everyone has one. That's the best part about it. Everyone has this one thing that, especially in the fast food realm, that they, when you say Wendy's, someone's mind will go to Frosty and French fries. That's the one thing that kind of comes to mind for someone. I feel like everyone has that kind of item that really stands out. And for me, it's this, you know, completely nonsensical breakfast taco that we call a taquito. And it comes in a flour tortilla, and you can get it with bacon if you want. You can get it with sausage, but I thought the hash brown one was perfect.
Is there one to an order?
There's one to an order. And if you're feeling really ambitious, you can get two or three.
So is it like a foot-long taquito?
No, it's...
Like 6 inches, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say about 6 inches. Yeah.
My local fast food memory has to do with a place that's no longer in business called Wetson's.
Okay.
And Wetson's...
Is that Connecticut?
No, it was in Long Island.
Okay.
Right across from E.J. Corvette's.
Okay.
Which, by the way, E.J., do you know what E.J. Corvette stands for? 8 Jewish Korean War Veterans?
Huh.
This is a true story, I think. I don't know. Maybe it's just lore. But when I moved to L.A. when I was a senior in high school... Actually, what became our fast casual experience of choice was actually a Tommy's Burger.
Oh, sure.
Which, you know, was not much of a chain. They tried to make it a chain, but my favorite part was when you'd ask for a milkshake, he would take one of those little pints of milk, shake it, and then he'd hand it to you, and that was their milkshake.
That feels very Tommy's. I've gone to Tommy's a few times when I've been in L.A., and I've really felt that kind of, you want something special? We'll make you something special and shake, you know, shake it up.
So when you were eating fast food, were you already thinking big thoughts about it, or was it just part of your adolescent experience?
It was a comfort food for me. I think that was all I really considered it to be, as something that, you know, even the adult menus at fast food restaurants kind of feel like a kid's menu. You know, there's something about eating something with your hands and taking it out of paper wrapping that feels kind of like a celebratory, innocent thing. So that really stuck with me. There was no formality required. And that's one aspect of it that's been, you know, sort of celebrated throughout its history, is that it's very democratic.
It is.
So,
along with pizza,
yeah,
and obviously pizza and fast food are now intersecting.
Exactly.
Curiously, you actually didn't write about much in the book.
Right.
Did you just make a decision that was just too much territory to cover?
Pizza's tough because it's hard to come up with a specific definition of fast food. Even, you know, fast food industry folks will tell you that fast food is something else than what it's commonly described as. They actually hate the term fast food. They call it QSR,
right. quick service restaurants.
So I kind of drew the line at places that have drive-thrus and combo meals and are cheaper than fast casual and maybe a ball pit with some bacteria in it. You know, that those are the kinds of those are the standards that
that was your definition of a fast food restaurant.
Right.
This episode of Special Sauce is brought to you by Capital One Saver Card. With the Capital One Saver Card, you earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment. That means 4% on milkshakes with the kids and 4% on music with your pals. You'll also earn 2% cash back at grocery stores and 1% on all other purchases. Now, when you go out, you cash in. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Adam Chandler, you go off to college and you become a journalist.
Right.
Tell us briefly about that path. And it wasn't to become a food journalist, right?
Right. It was a weird path, I would say, in that I didn't intend to become a journalist either. I went to an MFA program at Sarah Lawrence, and I studied nonfiction writing. So I went from having weeks-long stretches to luxuriate on an essay. And after that, I sort of figured, what am I going to do here afterwards? So I entered journalism in the age of blogging, where you have not weeks, but minutes to luxuriate on a topic.
Welcome to my world in 2006.
Exactly. So I wrote a lot about the Middle East, which was sort of how I got started. I was living abroad in Israel in between high school and college. For whatever reason, that was extremely interesting to me, and it was a tumultuous time. And then I came back to America, and it became a tumultuous time in America. In Israel, the Intifada broke out. The second Intifada broke out while I was there as a student.
What year was that?
2001.
Okay.
And then I went to school in Washington, D.C., and my third week into school was 9/11. So I think I was really heavily influenced by what was happening in the world, and it kind of affected, I think, I became a more politically minded person than I think I anticipated to be. And that sort of led me through, I'd say, my first 15 years of college and even journalism. But throughout it all, I think food was kind of lurking in the background because I always had this sort of latent interest in it.
So, like, you wrote for Tablet, you started their political blog, right? Or
I didn't start it, but I did what I could to continue it.
And Tablet is a contemporary a magazine about contemporary Jewish culture.
Right.
And then you ended up at The Atlantic.
Right.
They didn't say, oh, we got to hire Adam Chandler to write about food.
Right. I begged them to let me write more about food. and they had just killed their food program.
Yeah, which my friend Corby Cummerett started.
Yes. I love Corby and I love his writing so much. And so I actually asked them to let me try to revive it, and they very politely said no. So I ended up writing more about business as a result of that. And that's kind of how fast food, I think, entered the picture. It was sort of, I started writing about food because I was covering news and world events, and it was very depressing and sad. And I would write about fast food as sort of a way to have something that was a little bit, no pun intended, easier to digest, you know, not dealing with the global war on terror or ISIS or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the million other things that I tended to write about. And so I found that, I guess, my perspective on it and just having kind of a love for it and a respect for the institution of fast food set me apart from other writers unexpectedly. I would get really strong responses to stories I'd write about fast food because I think the fact that I enjoy it came through. And
yeah, and that was politically so incorrect, dude.
Yes, yes. But I'm obviously respectful of the shortcomings. I can't help but notice them and you know, believe that real change needs to happen. But I do think that a lot of the blame for fast food gets shifted onto the people who are buying fast food or who happen to love it or happen to find comfort in it and not to sort of the systems around it that make it problematic. And also, I was bartending when I moved to New York. So I worked in really nice bars that were attached to Michelin star chefs, and I worked at dives. And some of the labor issues and some of the health issues we talk about when we talk about fast food are very deeply entrenched in the restaurant industry, too.
For sure. And of course, there's the fight for 15.
Yes.
Now, my friend Steve Greenhouse just wrote a book about – he was the labor reporter at the time.
He's amazing.
I think the title of the book is Beaten Down, Worked Up. But he wrote a chapter in that about the tomato pickers in Florida
right.
forcing Burger King's first Burger King to pay more to these pickers.
Right.
So there's inextricable links between fast food and every aspect of American culture.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what I picked up on, not just in your book, but like you wrote that hilarious piece about getting a Taco Bell phone, which, which if you go to Adam Chandler's website, you can read. But it was hilarious. But you do this magic trick, which is you take the topic seriously and explore all the connections to all the aspects of fast food without taking yourself too seriously. And that's a really hard line to straddle. And that's actually what I look for at Serious Eats contributors. Like, they can take their subject seriously without taking themselves too seriously. You know, right. Kenji and I used to talk about this for hours at a time. So that's, I think, your gift to all of us is that, you know, you're an unabashed fan of fast food. And that piece about getting the free phone, which turned out not to be really free.
Right. There's no such thing as a free Taco Bell cell phone.
Yeah. So you were writing occasionally about fast food, even when you were at The Atlantic and when you were at Tablet and when you were whenever you could, right?
Right.
While you were feeding the sociopolitical beats you were supposed to be covering.
Right. Exactly. I was given a little bit of slack to get away with things. And it would turn out to be, you know, some of the better responses I would get to stories would not be, you know, an impassioned treatise about the Israeli-Arab conflict or anything like that. It would be about a double down at KFC. And that's sort of what people want when they log on to the internet sometimes. They don't want to read about certain things that feel intractable. They want to read about something that, you know, gives them a break, a reprieve. And I think that's sort of what fast food does in a culinary and an editorial sense.
Mm-hmm. If you could give me a list of your five favorite things to eat, what would they be?
Obviously, the Whataburger breakfast taquito
okay.
will top my list. And I have a really disgusting ritual that I've had from sixth grade on where I would order nachos Bel Grande at Taco Bell. And I order two tacos to go along with it. And sometimes it's the Doritos Locos Taco, which is the newfangled since 2012 Dorito shell
right.
taco. And I eat the two tacos on top of my nachos. So whatever falls out of the taco lands onto the nachos, and therefore I have like a deluxe nachos.
All right, I like that.
Which is my private – I can't do this in front of anyone else.
Yeah. Some things are meant to be eaten in private.
Right, exactly.
I've learned that, by the way, the hard way.
Right. It should be like when you go to, you know, to a ramen shop and you just have those booths where you don't have to look at anyone.
Right.
I feel like that's most of my existence in fast food restaurants should be that way. The Wendy's spicy chicken sandwich, I think, is phenomenal. I love it. And
well, that's a controversial move given the Popeye's chicken sandwich introduction.
Right, right. I think Popeye's did a good job with it. I have so many years with that spicy chicken sandwich from Wendy's. I've grown with it. I used to hate mayo and I used to hate tomatoes, and now I order it with mayo and tomatoes. I've grown as a human being into the sandwich.
Yeah, so it's expanded your food consciousness.
That's a generous way of putting it, but I will take it. I will take it. Let's see. And I love a McFlurry at McDonald's. It's just, I think it's perfect in some ways.
It's cold and almost creamy.
Right. It's cold and almost creamy.
And sweet.
It has the texture. It really comes down to texture. What I think fast food does well is has items that are just full of texture. You bite into something that is kind of crisp, and then it's kind of cold, and then, you know, it's just a beautiful melange of texture and temperature. So that's four. And Boy, I don't know. The Cajun chicken biscuit at Bojangles, which I only have at I only tend to have at airports because there are a few major hubs, whether it's Charlotte or United, that fly through places with Bojangles, and I stop and get this biscuit, and I'm a happy traveler. It puts me at peace in a stressful place. So
you have incredible breath. I mean, your purview is so wide in fast food. It's very impressive.
That is. I really hope my girlfriend's listening to this. We have a ritual for the last 5 years, 4 years. We've gone to White Castle on Valentine's Day. So I have to do a special shout out for that because I don't know if you know this. At White Castle, they do table service every Valentine's Day. They have a red tablecloth.
I have to say, I didn't know that.
Well, you heard it here. 50,000 people do this every year on Valentine's Day. You have to get reservations weeks in advance or else you'll get a 4 o'clock slot. But from 4 to 9 at every White Castle across the country, almost every White Castle across the country, they do table service and they have really beautiful plastic flowers and little chocolates, and they come up to the table and they take your order, and it's really wonderful. And you have young families and you have old couples and you have people who just don't want to spend their time, you know, fighting it out in Manhattan or elsewhere for a table when they can just have
so
sliders.
Awesome.
And it's great. It's a lot of fun.
I don't know. I could get into serious trouble, Adam, if I suggest to my wife that we go to White Castle for Valentine's Day. I don't know, but maybe not. And now we can get the Impossible Burger,
right?
The Impossible Slider.
You can get an Impossible Slider. We did the Impossible Slider this year, and it was, you know, I have my own issues with it, but I think it's good. And I'm more a fan of seeing people just having a low-key Valentine's Day that's kind of about love, and I think that that's fun. And people are all kind of interested in talking to each other at this event because everyone's sort of, what are
right.
you doing here? What are you doing here? There's a...
It's the experience.
Yeah, exactly.
And I presume they don't raise their prices.
They don't raise their prices. You get to leave a tip for a fast food worker, which is something, you know, we should be able to do somehow anyway, but can't. And it's a really pleasant experience.
Yeah. We haven't even gotten really into drive-through dreams. So I want to hear much more about the book, but we have to leave it right here for now.
Okay.
And now it's time to check in with the Serious Eats Test Kitchen crew.
There's so many ways to cook a steak.
Serious Eats Managing Culinary Director Daniel Gritzer.
One of my personal favorites is to do it old school style in a hot pan with oil, butter, aromatics like thyme and garlic. Yes, it's easier to mess up. It is easier to overcook your steak. Yes, you will have more of a doneness gradient than if you use a method like sous vide or the reverse sear. But man, do you get flavor in return. You get the most crunchy, crusty, roasted exterior to the meat you can imagine. And if you do it right, it's still tender and juicy and beautiful in the center. What kind of steaks can you use for this? Any tender, quick cooking cut. So like tenderloins, also known as filet mignon, ribeyes like I have here, T-bones, porterhouses, strip steaks, skirt steaks, hanger steaks, anything that remains tender even when it's rare or medium rare. The other thing I've done in advance of cooking the steak is I have done what's called a dry brine. What that means is I season the steak all over with salt, top, bottom, sides. I had it on a wire rack and I let it air dry for at least 1 hour. That's enough time for the salt to draw out moisture from the steak. Then it gets real wet and kind of puddly on top, and still enough time for it to reabsorb that moisture. You only want to dry brine if you have enough time to allow the steak to dry off before you put it in the pan. Moisture is the enemy of good browning. We always want the steak dry. This is a fast method where things kind of, you know, they don't happen instantaneously, but you need to be ready. You have to have everything mise en place, can I verbify it like that? Everything, have a nice mise en place all set up. You don't want to have to be running to your refrigerator, finding your thyme sprigs or anything like that once you start. As soon as the steak goes in the pan, you're on until it's out of the pan. I've got my oil to start it off, neutral oil, high smoke point. This is canola. I got my steak, got my butter that I'll add to the pan after I get the initial sear on this and then start basting it. I have some nice fresh thyme, flavor, and garlic, Got my instant read thermometer to take the temp on the steak. I also have some tongs. I have a slotted offset spatula. And very importantly for butter basting, I have a nice big spoon to baste with. You just want that oil as hot as it can get, flirting with the smoke point. All right, this oil's smoking. Ready? Steak. We're gonna flip it every like 15, 20 seconds. That old cooking tip that you should not flip your meat too much is not true. The more you flip it, the more even of a doneness you'll get in the center. That's what the spatula's for. Flip it. And what we're going for here is just a nice, hard sear right at the beginning. Nice crust. The reason I don't add the butter too early is because I want to get a really good sear on this steak first, and butter has some water content that will drop the temperature of the pan a bit when it first goes in, but also it has milk solids that will scorch and burn the longer it's in the pan. So I really want to like just get this super, super, super high heat with the oil first to get that really good sear. Then I can add the butter. I can even lower the heat a little bit. In goes the butter, in goes the thyme, in goes the garlic. Tip the pan and baste. In this butter, it's infusing now with the garlic and thyme flavor. The milk solids are browning and taking on a deeper, more complex flavor. And by doing this, I'm also cooking the steak from the top and bottom at the same time. It's kind of enveloping it in this intense, scalding hot fat. You still want to flip that steak. If you leave it too long on any one side, it's always going to cook more intensely from the bottom up, so you'll get an uneven doneness. For me, this just scratches every carnivorous muscle in my body. Yeah, I'm going to take this out. All right, here we go. Let it rest. The steak is cooked perfect medium rare, which is harder to do with this method than the other ones, which really kind of make it easier to nail the doneness. I think I'll just take a bite. Oh, so tender. Oh my God, whoa. What you really get here is just this profound, seared, crispy crust and such good roasty flavor. And every bite, you can hear in your ear this like potato chippy kind of crinkle as the crust crackles between your teeth. It is really good.
Sirius Eats Managing Culinary Director Daniel Gritzer.
It's so good.
More from our test kitchen next time. That's it for today. Next week on Special Sauce, Kenji will be back to answer with his usual scientific precision your culinary question of the week. Do send in your questions to specialsauce@seriouseats.com. All this, we'll have Adam Chandler back again on next week's Special Sauce. So long, Serious Eaters. See you next time.